the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron. How you doing, man?
It was a hot one this weekend, wasn't it?
It was a hot one.
As
although,
they say.
You know, I was out on Long Island. It wasn't that bad, but I know where you were over this past week.
I'll tell you something. Or what are we referring to, New Jersey?
Absolutely.
It's weird, though. I like the heat. I do. I'm a weird kind of guy. I grew up in New Mexico. My brother lives in Arizona. I love it when it's hot. I was actually in my rent a car that I rented to go to Hasbrook, New Jersey with on Friday night.
Hasbrook Heights.
Yeah, Hasbrook Heights. I kept it. I kept it an extra day to go out to IKEA to pick up a few things.
Now, which one did you go to?
I went to the one out on the island in Hicksville.
Oh, in Hicksville.
So I went out to the island. I'm driving, and I got my windows open, and everyone's looking at me like I'm some sort of idiot. But there's something about the heat and the sweating that makes me feel kind of buzzed. You know, it makes me, when it gets humid, if I'm not feeling nauseous and like my head's about to explode, I kind of like, it kind of makes me feel high. And I guess from a guy who doesn't get high anymore, I'm kind of hooked on the humidity. Like, I'm just like going to go out and feel like I'm disjointed, and that's good.
Well, now, wait a minute. Did you get that first couple of beads of sweat where you could look down at your shirt and you could see you?
I got it now. when it's humid out, I got sweat all the time, whether it's cool or not. And I walk into the Sai Baba health food store around the corner from me, and there's the one, you know, sort of bright-eyed, beamy-eyed guy there. He's like, how are you handling the heat? You
know, trying,
no. No, he tried to make conversation with me, and I just look at him and go, I like the heat. And he just went, ha, 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 ha. Like he couldn't even process how I was, you know, how I turned around and derailed his, just his little conversational point. Anyways, Hasbrook Heights, slow down, Marin. It's Monday, take it easy.
That's all right, man.
I'm all worked up. Hasbrook Heights was very nice. We had a nice crowd, had a lot of people came down to listen to the show, the people that won tickets in Brooklyn from the T-Lounge.
From the T-Lounge. We want to thank everybody that came to the T-Lounge on Friday. We had a great crowd of people there.
It's a great place.
It was a great crowd
of people, and people were very appreciative, and people had a great time. We had a great show. All the guys from our show, all the cats who do the characters really showed up. It was tremendous.
It was a lot of fun.
And then people came out to Hasbrook Heights. I was surprised. This is a Holiday Inn on Route 17. and they came out, and they were very supportive. They enjoyed the show. They had a good time. I had one guy right at the beginning of the show, right after I started talking about Bush, to the thunderous applause of people who know me. One guy goes, I thought this was going to be a comedy show.
And, you didn't spit on him or anything.
No, I didn't spit on him. I actually was sort of like, okay, sir, I dig what you're saying. It actually has been pretty funny, but clearly not the kind of funny that you're used to. But, you know, just hang in there. And I tried to be fairly diplomatic. But, you know, the people that love me and love the show, they were like, no, get out. I was like, whoa. I'm 5 minutes in here, folks. Let's try and move through this. And the guy actually eventually got pissed off and left. If you want a review of the show, I recommend that you go to brilliantatbreakfast.blogspot.com. This woman is a big fan of our show, and she has a nice little blog, and she was there, and she forwarded me the review and put it into context. It was very nice of her. It's brilliantatbreakfast.blogspot.com. There's other stuff there too. She's a nice person, Jill, and she comes to all our stuff.
Well, you know, you were in the Bergen Record, my local paper, on Friday.
Oh, yeah?
Complete with picture. And as a matter of fact, Saturday, one of my friends says, hey, man, your boy's in the paper.
What'd he do? Did he get arrested? So I go to IKEA, man. I was so glad I knew what I wanted to get. I was so, you know, there's nothing better than going to that place just going, I got two, like a mission. I'm going in, I'm getting the blinds, maybe an office chair, and then I'm getting out. So I go in, I get the blinds, I bought some jars, I got
silverware,
placemats, I got a plate, you know, I got a can opener.
Every male that goes to IKEA buys a plate. Right. I don't care what you're going in there to buy, you come out with at least one plate.
Exactly. Your wife's looking at curtains, you're going to redecorate the whole house. You walk through the store holding one plate. I want the plate.
The plate is on sale.
Yes, on sale.
Man, I got caught in the worst traffic, Marin. You have not lived until you spent 2 hours on a highway at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yes.
It was just agonizing.
That's the worst because you just, you're home in your head.
Yeah.
You're home in your head and you're like, is there any, why can't I fly?
And you know what? You really get real, I got real selfish, man.
Yeah.
Like, what are all you people doing on the road?
Yeah.
You get the hell off the road. Don't you know I got some place to go?
I got no right.
Yeah.
I got stuck in, I was deterred by Jesus. Yesterday, coming back
Reverend
from
Billy.
Yeah, coming back from IKEA.
Yes.
I had to go through Flushing, and I thought I was going to miss it. It's at 3 o'clock. The Reverend Billy Graham performed in Flushing. That was at 3 o'clock. Performed. Listen to me.
No, no, that's what it was.
Crusaded, sought to change people's hearts and minds. He was doing that, and I thought I was going to make it home, but I got stuck right in it for about a half an hour. Just people, you know, setting up shop, getting to Flushing Meadows to hear him. You know, we might
selling Billy T-shirts.
Well, we might as well get into Billy Graham for a second because we were going to talk about him anyways.
Yeah.
Now, Billy Graham has been around for years. He's one of the original Christo-fascist zombie brigade leaders. He comes from the old school, though. He preached to more than 210 million people in over 185 countries and territories over his career. He rose to prominence in the 50s.
Yeah, you know how, don't you?
Tell me.
All right, let's start. I'll give you this in a nutshell.
Okay.
Billy Graham came along during the height of the communist scare.
Right.
Okay, during McCarthyism, all of that.
Yes.
The key then was they didn't just say communist, they said godless communist.
Yes.
Billy Graham spoke to the godless part.
Right.
Billy Graham spoke out against communism in the context of the gospel, in the context of scripture, and in the context of the widespread belief in America that the Soviets squashed religion.
So he was right there at the beginning of the Cold War and really sort of exploited that in terms of building his following. His crusades were about saving souls.
Yes.
I mean, he's one of those guys that does it old school, has a procession of people come out that get saved.
Yes.
And apparently,
give me a life to Jesus.
Yes. And apparently at the beginning, he didn't necessarily align himself with partisan politics.
No, he didn't. But ironically enough, and this was what, you know, I'm looking, I see Bill Clinton was at the at one of the crusades. And what it turned out that Billy Graham, and I didn't know this, Billy Graham in the mid-50s, refused to speak to an audience in Little Rock, Arkansas, unless it was integrated. And Clinton was a kid at the time, and he never forgot that.
And it blew his mind.
It blew his mind.
Also,
yeah.
I might add that it seems like Billy Graham, which will be, I mean, really one of the first Christian evangelists that I know of to support
him. Evangelist?
Evangelist. Yeah, that's a good one. Evangelist.
Evangelist.
I think I'll write that one down, Riley. And, no, he was one of the first Christian evangelists to actually, throw his hat into to support Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign.
Okay. Yeah, you know, Billy Graham, over the last few years, has not jumped on the bandwagon of the Pat Robertsons and the Jerry Falwells and the James Dobsons. He has not spoken out against gay marriage, against many of these.
Just Jews.
Yeah, just Jews. Now, that is an eternal stain on this man. That casual anti-Semitism that was during the Nixon administration, during those candid conversations between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it interesting that a lot of people who monitor anti-Semitism never really called Billy Graham on it, certainly never called Nixon on it when he was alive.
Yeah, well, I think I read about it and I knew about it, so I mean, it's definitely out there in the world.
Oh, it's out there.
Well, it was just interesting because he said to Clinton, he literally, I think he was making a joke, but he called the Clintons quote unquote a great couple unquote, quipping that the former president should become an evangelist and allow quote his wife to run the country end quote. So Hillary's got the blessings of Billy Graham. Now look, when coming up in our conversation, Riley, we've got a lot of stuff to do today. We're going to get to a lot of points. Matt Cow is here, and I believe that we should open our eyes to Beefgate. I believe that there was a cover-up on behalf of the FDA and the USDA, and we're going to parse that a little bit. The president is sort of workshopping his message for his Tuesday address on the year anniversary of the turnover of power in Iraq, and he's putting his BS together, and there's a lot of conflicting messages. Literally, the information around Iraq is just as much of a quagmire as what's going on the ground in Iraq,
yep.
And we're going to try and parse that. So good morning. I hope you had a great weekend. We're back at it. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio with Mark and Mark. It's 15 past the hour.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
We'll be right back.
about the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're going to get into it, you know, in an attempt to counter the latest polls, some saying that 49% of the people polled believe George W. Bush started the war in Iraq and not Saddam Hussein. Bush is gearing up to address the nation on the eve of the anniversary of the turnover of power to Iraq at Fort Bragg. And that's we're going to get into that. We're going to get into the mad cow Beefgate story. This is a cover-up, people, as far as I can tell. And also, the Italians have put out a warrant to arrest about 13 CIA officers. Big that.
Hey, Mr. Maron?
Yes, sir.
Sorry to bother you, but...
That's right, Kalo.
We have Future Mark on line one.
Oh. Future Mark, that guy's great. Put him through. Hey, buddy,
what's up?
Hey, man, what's going on in 2050?
Nothing much. Doing a little prison time.
You're in prison?
Uh-huh.
What'd you do, man?
I didn't do anything. I'm being detained. They don't have to charge you with anything.
That's totally unconstitutional, man. Aren't you pissed?
No, man. I'm just doing my civic duty. The prison system got so huge, got to be such a big part of the economy, that everyone has to pitch in and support it. It's pretty much all that's left as far as, you know, employment goes.
What?
You know, you work the farm, do the laundry, be a guard, work as prosecutor, warden. Now it's just my turn to be a prisoner.
Do you just get called up to go to prison? It's like jury duty or something?
No. Cops come by and cuff you and drag you down there. It's usually someone you know, a neighbor. They're just doing their cop shit. I did mine last week.
Cop? We were a cop? Am I a good cop?
Did you see the movie Bad Lieutenant?
Yeah.
Bit of a loose cannon, my friend.
Oh.
I usually pull my badge and my blaster way before my shift is over.
I knew if I was ever given a gun and a little power, I'd turn into an a-hole. Wait, did you also say we were a prosecutor?
Yeah, and a defender. Everybody takes turns working in every part of the legal system, get it? It's more fair that way. And, you know, all the best universities have moved to prisons. I've applied to Harvard Leavenworth. I want to go back to prison school so I can be a judge. Of course, my safety prison school is Cal State Long.
Whoa, what's that? What's going on?
I don't want to be tortured.
Tortured? Come on, we still got torture?
Hard habit to break, dude. It gets results. Besides, after we dumped the Geneva Convention, the whole world started whining like babies. So rather than give up torture, now everybody gets tortured. It's kind of a way to save the world. We can dish it out, and we can also take it.
God!
It sucks, but it's fair.
You know how I am. I can't take physical pain. What are they going to do to us?
Well, you know, it's up to Joe Rogan, really.
Joe Rogan? The host of Fear Factor?
Yeah, but now he's the host of Torture Night Live. It's like this show the whole world watches. So the torture has to be kind of funny and interesting.
Oh, my God. I can't believe we're going to be tortured by Joe Rogan, and he's not even doing stand-up. What do you think he'll do?
I don't know. It's hard to say, really. Probably put on a puppet show making fun of my God. Maybe some half-drowning. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to eat a bag of crickets. Plus, I'll be nude. The audience loves that.
That is barbaric, man.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, after I'm tortured, I'm going to a nice dinner, and I'm thinking about treating myself to a shopping spree.
In prison?
Uh-huh.
How does that work?
Well, dude, the private sector saw these inmates and said, hey, why aren't we in there? So I'm going to probably go to Red Lobster tonight and eat me some shrimps, and then maybe go to Banana Republic before lockdown.
Wait, whoa, whoa. So the prisons have shops and restaurants?
And churches and stadiums.
Stadiums?
Yeah, well, they figured since most of the athletes wind up here anyways, why not move all the leagues inside?
Mm.
NFL, baseball, hockey, a lot of hockey.
All right, wait, so from what you're saying, the U.S. in 2050 is just one big prison?
Always was, Mark. Always was. Well, here goes nothing. Ow, jeez, Joe, come on, man.
Sorry, man. Riders are tired. Focus group likes.
I gotta go, dude. I'll talk to you later.
Whoa, wait, aren't you going to warn me about something?
Isn't this enough?
Yeah. I guess I should be really cool with Joe Rogan from now on, huh?
Couldn't hurt. See ya, buddy.
Later. Hey, there you go, man. Speaking of torture, I just wanted to get this in here. A report by researchers from Human Rights Watch and the ACLU discusses a tactic the Justice Department has been using to detain suspects suspected based on nothing other than they might be terrorists. And this is the material witness warrant. Apparently, at least 70, mostly Muslim men, have been held without charges using these material witness warrants. The material witness laws enables law enforcement to detain suspects who might have material info about a crime, even with no evidence that they have committed the crime itself. Yeah, and now, I didn't know about this, Riley, but apparently 70 suspects, and out of the 70 suspects, 7 were charged with terror-related crimes, 42 were released with no charges, and another 20 were charged with other crimes, and apparently there's been at least 13 apologies been issued for wrongful arrest. I wonder what that
13?
Answer
is.
Yeah, sorry about your testes.
Oh,
we didn't
yeah.
mean to burn them, but we thought you knew something. According to the report, the material witness warrant may have led to the most civil liberties abuse since 9/11, where they've arrested people for wrong reasons. It's just an exploitation of a rarely used type of warrant. Now, getting into Iraq, Now, as I said, apparently, you know, Bush and Jariri, the Iraqi prime minister, showed up at a White House press conference on Saturday, and it seems like George W. Bush basically played bad cop to Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari's good cop when they held this joint press conference, right?
Yeah, this is one of those hard work press conferences.
He was revisiting his angle that he used during a debate, which is that apparently he alluded to the high levels of difficulty in dealing with Iraq, no fewer than 19 times in his 33-minute appearance. 19 times, like, wow, man, it's a mess. This is hard.
Hard work. Now, I think he did this on Friday with Jafari. And I saw a tape of this on the BBC News. Uh-huh. I was just happened to be channel surfing. Mark, it was absolutely one of the most embarrassing moments I've ever had as an American. I'm not kidding about
really?
It. Really? To see this man fumble and stutter and look around like a caged animal. In the midst of trying to explain he had that darty look, like, how do I get out of here? Carl?
Yeah.
I mean, it was scary.
And then he made a joke, you know, referring to
a very little joke.
How his second term was going, and he actually made a joke saying that it's sort of like a quagmire. I'll find the exact text on that in just a second. But the thing is he is gearing up to sell the American people a bill of goods about how Iraq is doing. His angle is that we're doing the best we can. We're trying, but it's hard work, and we got to stick with it. And meanwhile, you've got Jafari saying, quote, I see from up close what's happening in Iraq, and I know we are making steady and substantial progress. This is the prime minister of Iraq. And then he switches to Iraqi and says, to translate it, I got this from the translation, obviously, quote, the bombing in Iraq has been reduced a lot, and we are making great progress. Everything is making progress, quantitatively and qualitatively, end quote. In a related story, there were 4 suicide attacks in the last 24 hours, killing 38 people.
Incredible. And then there's just recent word of a helicopter going down. They don't know how many casualties there. They don't know who shot it down or whether it was shot down. But there's a helicopter that's just gone down recently.
And even Rumsfeld says this is not unlike the Tet Offensive, that these suicide bombers know exactly what they're doing, and they're trying to make us, you know, see that it's not worth it. And you know what? It might not be. Obviously, this is not a lesson that they seem to have learned from Vietnam.
That's right.
We got the iNews coming up next.
And we're going to talk about mad cows, something that should scare each and every meat eater out here. Next on Air America Radio.
Boarding Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program on Monday. Good morning. Hope you had a good weekend. Let's get into this iNews thing here, because there's so much information. My mind's about to blow. I haven't eaten meat in 4 months, and now it's like it might not have been long enough because we got beefcake on the menu. I'm telling you, it's a cover-up. We're being duped here about this mad cow thing, and it scares me. So hang in for that. But right now, let's get the machine out. We just unpacked it from
Brooklyn.
The iNews 5,000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's feed it some headlines from the Washington Post. Rogue. Yes, I'm sorry. Oh, boy.
Slow down, baby.
Man, I know I'm going to hit a wall here.
Don't worry
about
it.
You know, it's like I have that energy that just means in about 15 minutes I'm going to be like, oh, no.
We're all praying for just a little bit more time.
Yeah.
From the Washington Post, Rove taking a more public role. Rove taking a more public role. Put that in the machine translation. Cosmetic surgeons hide tail, horns, and mark of beast. From Associated Press, Jordan bans Saddam's new novel. Translation, Saddam's spider hole sex scene deemed too spicy. Too spicy down in the hole. From the Associated Press, California pot crackdown may net more arrests. Translation, Schwarzenegger's approval rating goes from bad to buzzkill, dude. If you were at the Tea Lounge, if you were at the Tea Lounge on Friday, you would have seen Brendan P.W. McDonald do that intro and outro live, and what an event that is.
In all his glory.
Someday we might have the technology to actually enable people to use that as a ringtone, but until, you know, we stop, you know, running our website by steam, I don't know that, you know, we're going to get to that. It's weird. We have the only website in the history of modern technology that, you know, when you open it, it's like... You got to have a valve on your computer to operate our website. Anyways, here we go. Not that I'm complaining. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy.
Ooh.
Get to know it. BSE, mad cow disease. All right, the agriculture department. Now, I'm saying welcome to Beefgate, my friends. The agriculture department, the USDA confirmed that a cow that died last year was infected with mad cow disease. It died last year.
Yes.
They've known about it since November. Some say there are systematic problems in the way animals are tested at the USDA. I say, folks, it's got to be a cover-up. I mean, the USDA has been pimped out by the beef industry. The FDA, who's supposed to be in charge of national health, you know, is in complete collusion with corporate interests, not the interests of us in our health. The cow in question, all right? See, the bottom line is that if they test effectively, like they do in other countries, if they test effectively, it will slow down production to a point where they will lose money.
Yes.
So obviously, that's what they're most paranoid about. So effective testing is out of the question. The cow in question was given two different tests. All right, the public knew nothing of these tests because, according to the USDA in a statement on Friday, one of the tests was just experimental, and the other one was negative.
Yeah.
So they only told us because they were scared enough to send the specimens, again, 2 weeks ago, to Weybridge, England, to get a really good test.
That was test number three.
Right.
That's the Western blot test, which is considered conclusive.
But yeah, it's considered conclusive, but what about the gold standard test of the USDA? See, an experimental test was performed last November on the brain of a cow suspecting of having mad cow. Experimental. Read, if it had come out negative, it would have been definitive. Because it came out positive, meaning it did not give the results that the USDA wanted, it was experimental. Another test that was referred to by the USDA as their gold standard test was given to the cow a little before the experimental test, and the gold standard test actually said it was negative, of course confirming that the other test was just experimental. Because it was positive. So the scientists were suspicious enough, obviously, that they sent it to England. And the USDA... All right. The USDA ignored the test, the silver standard test, the positive test that happened here because it wasn't the gold standard, I guess. But, you know, they did now have to admit to it, and now they're blaming the scientists. On Friday, Ed Lloyd, the USDA spokesman said about the first test, the positive one that was done here, the experimental one, quote, the laboratory folks just never mentioned it to anyone higher up. They didn't know whether it was valid or not, so they didn't report it. Oh, okay, so it was a scientist's fault.
Well, you know, we ought to, Mark, give a shout to Phyllis Font from the Agriculture Department, the Inspector General, without whom we would not have had the Western blot test. She was the one that ordered
pushed for it.
Yeah, she pushed for the Western blot, and that, of course, made it 2-1 in favor of, yes, this cow did have mad cow, and that's why there are currently 36 countries that have shut their doors to U.S. beef.
It's just, to me, it just stinks. It's so confusing. You got these two tests. There's obviously a cover-up because you got this guy saying it's a scientist's fault, and that's just so like a scientist, isn't it? To come up with a threat that the entire nation's meat supply and the health of anyone who eats American beef is doesn't raise a red flag because they didn't want to bother anyone because the test wasn't the gold standard test. It's ridiculous. Does the USDA think we're stupid? And then Lloyd went on to say, quote, in hindsight, reporting it would have been the right thing to do. End quote. Now, that's Ed Lloyd, a USDA spokesman. Of course it would have been the right thing to do, but that would put the beef industry into trouble.
I got news for you, Mark. They're already in trouble. When a buddy of mine over this past weekend, who has never used the words mad and cow in the same sentence, eats a hamburger and says to me, you know, I shouldn't be doing so much of these because I'm a little worried about this mad cow.
But see, the weird thing is that eats a hamburger. One of the guys that just started working for us here said his mom is involved with this, and he knows, everyone knows it's been here for at least 10 years, people have died from it, but they're like, hey, I might still eat meat. You know,
he's hungry.
It's the same thing. It's sort of like, sometimes I wear a condom. You know what I mean? It depends how I feel.
Now you're going to put it to a condom.
But dig this. All right, so now they have to rely on DNA testing. Here's why I think it's a cover-up, because now they cannot just go and find out where they got the cow, you know, because that's, of course, they got to figure out, they're going to try and blame Canada or wherever, or maybe the cow came from outer space, but now they got to use a DNA test, all right, because you know why? Dig this. They have to use DNA testing to find out where the cow came from, which is a long shot, and the reason that, you know, they have to use DNA testing is, according to John Gifford, the USDA chief vegetarian, chief veterinarian, John Gifford, the USDA chief veterinarian, all right, the cow was labeled as the wrong breed. It had been soiled with so much, because why? Because A, it had been soiled with so much manure that it was hard to tell what breed it was. Appetizing, huh?
B,
the tissue samples were mixed with other tissue samples from other cows. Parts from the deceased animal were supposed to be kept separate, but they somehow got mixed up with the remains of four other cows. How does that happen? Sabotage, I ask?
I don't know.
There are four buckets, all right, that say, we got to send these remains out for testing. How easy would it be for someone to go, oh, yeah, not this cow. How is it going to test now? Let's just mix these up. Maybe I'm being paranoid. I don't know.
Maybe it was like Igor from Young Frankenstein who came to get the normal brain and got the AB normal brain instead. I don't know how this kind of thing happens, Mark, but here's the bottom line. We are looking at the possibility, and see, government is supposed to act in the public interest here, and you have people who still end up mixing these different feeds, mixing animal waste, mixing restaurant waste into feed that they are then feeding back to us through these animals, whether it's cows, chickens, pigs, all of them.
Well, that's the deal, is that they put some safeguards into place. They say about not feeding cows directly cows or cow's blood, even though we're going to have a guest on our show. I'm going to replay some sound that contradicts that.
Yeah.
But not only that, is that they still use brains and spine in bone meal they feed the chickens, and then they feed the chicken feces to the cows, and the bones and spine of the cows, if they're infected, is where the mad cow hangs out. And according to co-author of Mad Cow USA, John Stauber, who was on our show, he explained that although the Bush administration says that cows and livestock are not being fed back to other cattle, that it's a lie. Can we hear that? This is from last week.
We know now that mad cow disease is here in North America. It's been here for a decade. And despite that, the United States government is simply lying to the public about the safeguards we've taken. You know, mad cow disease is spread through feeding cows, slaughterhouse waste from cows and other livestock. We hear that we have a firewall feed ban in the United States that has prevented this since 1997. The reality is, no, that's not the truth. It's just a labeling restriction, and legally, hundreds of millions of pounds of slaughterhouse waste are fed back to cattle every year. The cattle industry simply won't give it up because they make so much money by turning slaughterhouse waste into animal feed, but other countries have banned it and are stopping the spread of the disease that way.
That was John Stauber, the co-author of Mad Cow USA, on our show last week. Seems a little sloppy, Riley, when you're dealing with the possibility of the nation's food supply being polluted with a deadly disease. I mean, what is with these? These are administration. This is the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration. But I do want to put out a comment made by Agricultural Secretary Mike Johans. He said on Saturday, just to put your mind at rest, quote, let's just reassure people there's nothing to worry about relative to bovine spongiform encephalopathy in our beef. Our safeguards work to keep the animal away from our food supply.
Change the name of it from mad cow to not feeling so well cow.
Right. Quote, the fact that this animal was blocked from entering the food supply tells us that our safeguards are working exactly as they should. End quote. 7 months after they found the animal, three tests later, knowing 7 months ago that it was probably in the food supply. What a saint this guy is, the former governor of Nebraska.
And one of his stooges allegedly threatened a group of Japanese lawmakers who came to Washington with trade retaliation unless Japan opened up its entire market to U.S. beef.
Look, testing practices. Japan tests every cow. Yep. Europe tests about 1 in 4. The United States tests 1 in every 90 cows. In 2003, when the first mad cow case was discovered in the U.S., it was testing 1 in 1,700. The U.S. performs 388,000 tests per year, up from 40 per year in 1990. Before the recent positive result, Johannes, the Department of Agriculture chief, was thinking about cutting back to 40,000 per year. The truth of the matter is that by virtue of the way the meat industry works, if there's one infected cow that gets into the food supply, that could contaminate, you know, any, like almost like probably 1,000 hamburgers. I don't mean to alarm people, but, you know, this, I think, is a cover-up, and this, I think, is going to be an unfolding story, and I think we're going to see that there are a lot more cases of this out there. It's important stuff that doesn't get reported as thoroughly as it should, but this is the nation's food supply. And I'm not eating beef, but I'm scared because I just stopped 3 months ago.
We're going to keep following this story because Mark is onto something here. This is an expanding scandal. Phyllis Fong, the Inspector General for the Agriculture Department, said last spring that this testing program was a crock. So let's follow it.
Coming up next, a strip show at the Department of Justice. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Monday. It's Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Yo!
Look at that. I forgot that happens once a week. It's the fax machine from the Streisand compound with our weekly liberal agenda. Write these down, liberal soldiers. These are your marching orders for the week. One, protest the use of the term mad cow disease as disrespectful to the morbidly obese mentally ill.
Uh-oh.
Two, for the fourth year in a row, offer therapy and understanding for our attackers. Three, call Bush's bluff and take a tour of Guantanamo. Note, make sure to dress like indigenous Cubans so as not to spread ugly American image. Four, for the 4th of July, develop a firework rocket that shoots up in the air, explodes, and spells out the Downing Street memo in red, white, and blue lights. Five, today's phrase just dropped this in a conversation. Hey, isn't Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari just Hamid Karzai without the stupid hat? Wake up, sheeple. Bush has more puppets than Jim Henson.
Ooh.
Huh? So let's talk about this striptease at the Justice Department. Now, John Ashcroft, in one of the more embarrassing moments in American governmental history, forced them to cover up the breast of justice on a statue at the Justice Department so he wouldn't be bothered with being a grown-up about the nudity of a statue representing justice. What a religious, fanatic, freaky child this guy was. It was embarrassing. It was one of those moments where I'm like, oh, and Europe's going to see us like this?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he wasn't actually the first one to do it, Mark. The difference with Ashcroft was that he had these things permanently Velcroed to the offending body parts.
Thornburg, so he had to get kinky with it.
Well, yeah, and see, the issue for some of these guys is apparently, you know, when they go out to hold press conferences in that great hall, they don't want this nude statue to be standing behind them. Well, our new attorney general, Alberto Gonzalez,
is here with boobs.
Yeah, he's an evil guy, but apparently he, you know, likes the spice or whatever.
Yeah, but what are we, children? What are we, children? It's a statue. It's a beautiful piece of a statue. So what? I mean, you ever go to a museum? What are they?
I know.
So Alberto Gonzalez, after toiling with this thing for however long he's been there, decides, let's be grown-ups and take this off. Are you kidding me? Do I have to like Alberto Gonzalez for being a grown-up? No.
He did it on the DL, though. I mean, he kept saying, look, I got other things to deal with. You know, there are too many other weighty issues before me.
And this all of a sudden one day, I was like, hey, the boob's out. Folks, the boob's out.
Yeah, he sent a couple of contractors down there and some construction people, and they took it
it off. Took it all off.
Well, that's good because it was embarrassing to try to present ourselves as a evolved, sophisticated, grown up country. All right, so why don't you tell me about the new NAACP president or executive? He is the president and chief executive officer, but also a business guy.
A business guy. This is a marked change for the NAACP. Of course, Kwaise Mfume was the former president, stepped down. He's now running for the Senate from Maryland. And in his place, the NAACP has chosen Bruce Gordon. Bruce Gordon is a retired executive with Verizon Communications. This is a departure from previous policy in that the NAACP very rarely, if ever, chose its leadership from the business community. It's always been from the civil rights community, the ministerial community. But this is a marked change. And I think it may actually mark a slight shift in philosophy as well in terms of the direction that the NAACP goes in.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about their vitality and their place in the community and what they really stand for. Do you think this is going to be more of how do you think he's going to approach it on the executive level? Because there has been, what does the shift mean to you?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, Bruce Gordon has been a member of the NAACP. He's 59. Mm-hmm. He's been a member for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So he's been around the NAACP.
So he knows how.
Yeah, his father was an organizer with the NAACP. So he's got history with the organization. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're bringing in somebody that knows nothing about its culture or its nomenclature. Gordon, on the other hand, he was at Verizon for 30-some-odd years. Before there was a Verizon, Bruce Gordon worked in the communications industry.
Mm-hmm.
So he brings that business head to the organization. And, of course, Kwaise Mfume will be remembered in terms of his presidency as a guy who took an organization that was deeply in debt and brought it back to solvency. Now, I think Gordon's challenge is going to be to keep the organization relevant because there's some people in the black community who don't think it is, and to maintain the base of membership and of support, I guess, from corporate America that will keep the organization viable financially.
Oh, so that's he's bringing a certain amount of business acumen to restructuring the NAACP. I want to apologize. I was pronouncing Mike Johans' name as Mike Johans because, you know, being that I have Dutch roots, I have no idea why. You know, I'm bad at names, and I also Ibrahim Jafari. I've said several different ways, hoping I'd hit it once.
I did hit it once.
I guess I've got to be more responsible about all this.
Oh, you know, don't worry about it. Here's a name you can do.
Who?
Shaquille O'Neal. Say it.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah.
Got an honorary degree.
He actually got a degree. This wasn't even honorary.
Oh, okay.
He got a real degree, an MBA, a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Phoenix Online, which is one of our advertisers here at Air America Radio.
I just assumed that he was like all celebrities. They were just like, here you go. Here's a diploma. But he did the work. Good for him.
Yeah, no, he said sports is a fairy tale life, and this right here is real life. This right here means more.
Wow.
So congratulations, Shaq.
Well, let's continue talking about Iraq, about Mad Cow. We're going to continue talking. We got the job listing coming up.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court a little bit. It's a big Monday here on Morning Sedition with Mark. And Mark, thanks for listening to Air America. And stay with us.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
On Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Happy Monday, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course you lurking conservatives. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. With Ashcroft gone, busty justice statues are finally uncovered. Workers at the Justice Department Friday removed the blue drapes that have covered two scantily clad statues for the past 3.5 years. They said within 3 minutes of taking the drapes off, their nipples hardened, and once again the room was filled with busloads of adolescent boys on school trips looking up. Blair's son, that's Tony Blair's son, to intern with U.S. Republicans. British Prime Minister Tony Blair's eldest son, Yuan, is that how you pronounce it? Ewan will work as an intern with Republican staff in the U.S. House of Representatives. Ewan, 21, says he looks forward to following in the footsteps of his father and then dropping to his knees and kissing most of the same asses. Despite Blair's close relationship with President Bush, the news raised eyebrows among some Democrats, and that's about as much a reaction as you can get out of them these days. Them subtle fighting gestures and raising the eyebrows. The commander-in-chief backs way off. Mission accomplished. President Bush told the press this weekend that, quote, it's hard to stop suicide bombers, and it's hard to stop these people that, in many cases, are being smuggled into Iraq from outside Iraq. It's hard to stop them. End quote. Then the reporters dropped their notepads and held him as he wept. All right. So those are clip notes for today. Look, you know, thanks to everybody who came down on Friday to see us at the Tea Lounge. It was great to see you in Brooklyn. We had a great time. What a great place that was.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had a nice time on Friday night performing in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. Had a great turnout. We had one dissenter, Republican righty guy who interrupted the show at the beginning, and it was I handled it the way I handle things. He was like, I thought this was a comedy show. And I was like, it is, and I said some funny things, but clearly I'm never going to say anything that you're going to find funny. I understand where you're coming from. He goes, no, you don't. And I'm like, all right, we're 5 minutes in, and this is that. And then the people in the audience are like, no, get out of here. He eventually paid his check and left. If you want to read a review of it, a friend of the show who comes to see us when we were live and a big fan, her name's Jill, and she does a blog called brilliantatbreakfast.blogspot.com. There's a review of my show and some other stuff if you want to check that out. An Italian judge has ordered the arrest of more than 13 people linked to the CIA for the kidnapping of an Egyptian terrorist suspect, Iman Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasir. And they're accusing them, the Italians are accusing the CIA operatives of flying into Egypt on the Boston Red Sox plane that had been leased to the CIA for their air torture extraordinary renditioning program. The imam said he was tortured. The way they tracked these guys were, they tracked these guys, the CIA guys, because they were initially helping the Italians in the surveillance of this guy who they were waiting to recruit some terrorists. The Italians actually, and Europeans in general, do it the old school way. They actually investigate terrorists, they find out who they're linked to, and they set up a prosecution to effectively, you know, make a case against them. So these 13 guys apparently working with the Italians, and then one day they're like, where's the suspect? Hey, we're the CIA guys. What the hell's going on here?
That's exactly what happened here, Mark. These guys, the Italian government was trying to make a case against both Abu Omar, who's the gentleman you described, Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasir, and some of his compatriots. They were trying to make a case the way you make an organized crime case. You go out, you get evidence, you get informants, you do the law enforcement work to make sure that you got an airtight case against these people. And by the way, America, while fighting the war on terror, doesn't always do this. But you encapsulated it perfectly. Here's a bunch of Italian officials who have been working with the CIA. They wake up one day, find out the target of the investigation has vanished, along with the CIA people that they're working with. This is some very, very bad business. It is potentially lethal for American intelligence efforts in Europe and in the Middle East in the future. Remember, America has cried for a long time about the lack of cooperation in intelligence gathering in both the Middle East and in Europe. And they do a lot of intelligence gathering in Europe because there are supposedly many terror cells throughout Europe, in Germany, in Britain, in many of these different countries. How much cooperation do you think local officials are now going to give the American CIA in the wake of this kind of nuts?
Yeah, exactly. And as you were saying before when we had a conversation, is that is this a coincidence that Karl Rove brought this up?
Yep.
as an accusation against liberals and Democrats for wanting basically legal process and investigations to be done? And he's basically saying this about Europe as well. And oddly, you know, I'm going to admit Jerry Springer had a very decent way of reacting to Karl Rove and accusing Democrats and liberals of wanting to undermine the troops in Iraq. Springer just spent, you know, an hour saying, really? You really think that 56 million Americans, that more than half of the Americans in this country want to undermine our troops? Do you really? I think I'm saying it like Springer, too.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. That is ridiculous.
It's
appalling. But, But yeah, I think that was a good way to frame it. But obviously, Rove was also referring to Europe as well.
He was referring to Europe.
His arrogance and their bullying, coercive ways. And it was interesting to me in learning some of the facts about this case in terms of the Italians that they were able to track the CIA operatives by cell phone records and also by hotel rosters of five-star hotels in these different places where the renditioning was done and also in Italy. And what was weird to me is that how CIA guys picked their assignments, like, to build vacations around it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like, oh, I'll be right by Venice. So after we drop the guy off to get his testicles fried for information, let's go down to Venice and hang out for a few days.
That's the scary part, Mark. What the U.S. intelligence community has said. And, you know, Porter Goss, I guess, is going to be the one that ends up paying for this, because somebody's going to pay sooner or later. But what the U.S. intelligence community is saying to the rest of the world is, look, our priorities trump your priorities no matter what. If we want to rendition somebody because we think that's the best way to deal with them, to hell with your investigation, we're taking them. Now, there is ample precedent in American law enforcement in terms of the FBI doing that sort of thing to local and state law enforcement right here in America.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, man, I'm not worried about your investigation. We're doing something else. We're the FBI later for you. And that's the same kind of attitude that is going to destroy American intelligence gathering. And, of course, in this case, it was the CIA, but it will destroy American intelligence gathering abroad.
Yeah, I think you're right. And speaking about abroad intelligence gathering, Iraq, you know, the president is now gearing up to make his presentation of BS to the American people. This, I'll tell you one thing about the neocon death cult and Rumsfeld and about, you know, George Bush, is that they've got some huge stones, some big cojones for this guy, given the information that's coming out of Iraq, given the fact that there are members of Congress on both sides, members of the Senate, who are questioning the integrity of the conflict at this point in time. There are people in the military saying we can't win it militarily. There are, you know, there's information of escalation of bombings, that terrorism numbers are going up around the world. Now, George Bush is gearing up and workshopping his message for Tuesday night, a year anniversary of the turnover of power in Iraq, and he's going to stand in front of the military and say, it's hard work, but there's more work to be done. And he's going to say that we're being successful.
No, it's BS. It's
yeah.
I mean, he's not going to say that. But what he's getting ready to say, Mark, you know, I looked at a story from last year when he spoke at the Army War College, and he's saying exactly the same thing that they're expecting him to say tomorrow.
Well, let's get into that next. It's 14 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. It's Air America Radio.
MorningsEdition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Team past the hour, America Radio's Morning Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
I hope you're having a good Monday. Tony Combs, the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary Twist of Fate. We'll talk about his decision to go public about the sexual abuse by a Catholic priest that he experienced as a boy. And joining him will be the film's director, Kirby Dick. The film debuts on HBO tomorrow night. They will be with us shortly.
Yeah.
And folks, look, here's what's going on. In Iraq, you know, just in the last 24 hours, all right, there were like four suicide attacks. 38 people were killed. You know, what's going on now in response to, you know, the desire by some members of Congress and certainly by some people in the military in terms of, you know, yeah, the troops are feeling, you know, like there's not enough troops. There's a lot of criticism about a timeline. Rumsfeld said that the insurgency could last as long as a dozen years. There's your timeline, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? He's compared the insurgents' tactics to the Tet Offensive and implied that the terrorists are very aware of suicide bombing tactics that make Americans convinced that the war is not worth the cost. Haven't these guys learned anything about Vietnam? That war wasn't worth the cost. Some unnamed sources say that there are military strategies on the table for a phased, deliberate drawdown, in, you know, progressive extraction of troops. And the troops are saying that there's not enough troops. And meanwhile, the president gears up for his BS presentation on Tuesday night in front of soldiers and the country at Fort Bragg a year after the turnover of power to Iraq. Now, you've got some information from the speech he gave exactly a year ago.
A year ago, actually May 25th, 2004. This was, of course, during the presidential campaign of last year. And President Bush then, and by the way, he gave this speech at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He called for the demolition of Abu Ghraib prison, and he said that the United States would succeed in turning Iraq from violence and chaos to democracy and peace. Now, Mark, what you have to realize is that Bush made this speech in direct response to many of the same kinds of things that are going on now. Public disenchantment with the war, people starting to question exactly what America's strategy was. And remember that this speech took place almost a month to the day before the two-day early handover of power in Iraq. Remember?
That's right. I remember because they were panicking. They're like, we got to make this happen no matter what.
Yes.
And now he's going into this speech on Tuesday with 49% of the people polled in a recent poll believing that George Bush and the neocon death cult started the war in Iraq, not Saddam Hussein. That's profound in relation to those numbers. And also, judging on, like he said, that the anchor of that speech, one of the big sort of concessions he was going to make to kiss up and try to spin this war as a good thing to the American people and to the world was that they were going to shut down Abu Ghraib because this was right after those photos were revealed.
Yeah, well, apparently not now. You fast forward to June of this year, and you find that U.S. commanders in Iraq are building new facilities at Abu Ghraib and Camp Buka near the Kuwaiti border. They're developing a third major prison. I guess the swelling number of insurgents that they've been arresting, I don't know, I thought they were killing off all these insurgents. Of course, kill them, you don't really need to detain them, but I think that what they're now trying to say is that we've got so many insurgents in custody, we have to somehow expand the prison facilities, and Abu Ghraib is the only place. There is no explanation from the White House, however, about this obvious contradiction between Bush a year ago saying it would close, and now they're saying not only will it remain open, but they will, in fact, expand it. And, Mark, there's even something more telling here.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a situation where George W. Bush talks almost weekly with James Abizade. Okay, now, as a matter of fact, every week he holds a video teleconference, with John Abizade, who's the commander of U.S. troops in the Middle East. Now, if you have a weekly video conference with this guy, how is it that he was so far off message compared to what Dick Cheney said around Memorial Day weekend, that the insurgency was in its last throes, and Abizade saying a couple of weeks later, this thing is in trouble?
Well, this is a standard propaganda device on behalf of the neocon death cult. What they do is create an informational quagmire so that you have different people coming from different angles saying contradictory things, which makes it almost impossible to decide what the truth is in terms of people just taking in this stuff in sound bites. They contradict each other constantly. And what I say is that judging by the speech from last year and what he said there, there's no reason to think that this speech this year is going to be any different. So none of it is to be believed. And then again, when you have people speaking from the military, and John Abizade is not an anti-neocon death cult guy. He's a real military guy. He's a team player. And he's saying that things aren't that great, that if anything, they might be the same as they were a year ago. And then you have other military personnel on the ground saying that like this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Frederick P. Wilman, who's in charge of task force to train the Iraqi military, quote, we can't kill them all. When I kill one, I create three, end quote. And then you have, Chuck Hagel, Senator Chuck Hagel, a Republican, no liberal, let me tell you, says things aren't getting better, they're getting worse. The White House is completely disconnected from reality. It's like they're just making it up as they go along. And also, Riley, despite Hagel, I mean, he's not on the ground there. We've got the people who are on the border of Syria trying to manage that border.
Yeah.
And these are military guys candidly saying, we don't have enough troops to do this. When we stop them in one place, they come in another. And there's so many issues at hand. And the bottom line, the issue is, this was the wrong war then, it's the wrong war now, and these guys are not willing to admit that they've got us into a situation that is unresolvable on a military military level, to the point where Rumsfeld had to admit the other day that they're meeting with insurgents. They're meeting with Sunni insurgents.
They are meeting with insurgents. Mark did not make a mistake there, ladies and gentlemen, because I know people are waking up and saying, what are you talking about? They're meeting with insurgents.
This administration will never negotiate with terrorists.
Yeah, no, that is exactly what they're doing. Because what now, Rumsfeld, of course, is trying to put this forward as some clever plan to separate the Sunni insurgents from the foreign fighters. That will happen once the Americans are defeated as far as the insurgents are concerned. Right now, they have a common enemy. And, you know, it is that enemy is embodied in the face of a guy like Donald Rumsfeld. So George W. Bush now has to go back to the American people and attempt to sell the same snake oil that got him elected last year.
And this move on behalf of Rumsfeld and talking to the insurgents is it's admitting on some level that there is no military solution, and they're trying to separate the insurgents and use political tactics.
Yeah, and, you know, you've got three guys. You've got Hagel, you got Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, and you got Walter Jones, the congressman from North Carolina.
Sure.
All three supported the war wholeheartedly. All three have now said, we got problems.
And then you also have Iraqis, who some Iraqis obviously want the troops to leave. And now, you know, look, you know, this is what it is. You know, I'm certainly not trying to undermine the troops. I'm not trying to, you know, to support, you know, the other side or anything. But there has to be a point where Americans have to know the truth about what's going on there and how we, you know, facilitate, you know, a leaving of Iraq with some.
Dignity is the word you're looking for.
You know, they just made a mess of this thing.
Yes.
And it was all built on lies, and now we're in it. It's just a disaster.
Bad business.
So we're coming up, next we're going to talk to Tony Combs, the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary, Twist of Faith. He's going to talk about his decision to go public about the sexual abuse by Catholic priests that he experienced as a boy. And coming with him is Kirby Dick, the film's filmmaker. So stay with us for that here on Air America Radio. 27 past the hour.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. It's Monday. I hope you're having a good Monday. Later in the show, I want to put this out there for the diehard fans. Ted Leo
is
going to come in here and jam. Those of you who know Ted Leo know him, and you love him. He's one of those guys that has a very hardcore following. If you haven't, he's an incredibly energetic performer. It's worth waiting around for.
Yeah.
Also, welcome to Beefgate, my friends. The Agriculture Department confirmed that a cow that died last year was infected with mad cow. It died last year, and they've known about it since November. Why haven't we known about it? I suggest there might be a cover-up. We're going to get into that in just a few minutes. Tomorrow night, the Oscar-nominated documentary Twist of Faith premieres on HBO. It's a true story of how one man decided to go public about being sexually abused by a Catholic priest when he was a boy. Please welcome to our show Tony Combs and the director of the film, Kirby Dick. Good morning, fellas.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tony, what led you to finally reveal publicly what happened to you?
At the church's invitation, most of the churches around the nation, once the abuse scandal blew up in Boston, set up their own kind of in-house counseling. They had offered, both publicly and privately, through different media outlets, that had you been a victim of abuse, you could come forward, they would provide counseling, set you on the right path to recovery, etc. During that process, I had requested that they do a number of things. One, be honest with me, regardless of how brutally honest he was, and I would continue to simply get counseling. I had no interest in standing outside the church throwing the proverbial stained glass or rocks to the stained glass windows, nor did I want to be hauled back up to the altar with the, hey, y'all, we fixed them, come on back.
Right, right.
I just wanted to get better for myself and for my family.
So how old were you when you made this decision, and how old were you when the abuse happened?
When the abuse began, I was 14. It ended when I was 16, basically, because I stopped rolling over, to put it pretty bluntly. When this process started, it was in probably December of 2001, January of 2002, that I had made contact with the diocese through my mother acting as an intermediary, going through our parish priest, then to a diocesan case manager, and then ultimately to a meeting with the then Bishop of Toledo, James Hoffman.
So you hadn't addressed it or talked about it in between those times?
I had spoken to my mother when I was 21 years
old.
Past the statute of limitations, which in Ohio is 2 years from the age of majority, so essentially your 20th birthday, unless you're legally emancipated from your folks, pregnancy or otherwise, you name it.
Did you get a sense in the immediate aftermath of this that anything was ever going to be done about what happened to you?
No. No. At the meeting with the bishop, my mother, my wife, and I each asked him individually three times, and this guy's been the captain of the diocesan ship for 20 years at this time, have you ever heard any prior allegations of abuse or improper or inappropriate behavior by this man, Dennis Gray, former Father Dennis Gray? No, no, and no was his answer. And I had said to him during the interview, if you are honest with me again, I take nothing but counsel and I walk out of here. If you lie to me, the gloves come off. And his response was, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, metaphorically speaking, I will lawyer up so fast your head will spin. And physically, should I happen to bump into you in the local grocery store parking lot, you had best hope you can make it to your Lincoln and lock the doors before I can make it to you. And he chose to lie. So I'm following through on my word. My legal end was the left hand, and this is the right hand.
And has there been any results of the legal action?
The legal action, a year ago May, I settled for approximately $55,000, which the church's initial offer was $5,000. It took 17 different trips back and forth for the mediator to get to that level. This was never about the money.
Sure.
This was about people coming forward and the responsible parties admitting what they had done was wrong, especially from the pulpit of moral authority where they have defended themselves, both in my lawsuit and countless lawsuits across the country with separation of church and state statutes of limitations. Yet they will, at their whim, select different laws from our civil and criminal judicial systems to defend themselves with, but they claim not to need them in the very same breath.
Sure, the hypocrisy is almost the unspoken scripture of the Catholic Church.
It is absurd.
So, Kirby Dick, you directed the film, and what, you know, obviously this is compelling and important issue, but how did you hear about Tony?
You know, I've been following the stories out of Boston and, you know, just how horrific the incidents of abuse were there. And I was looking to tell this story through one person. So we went to an organization called SNAP, which is the Survivors Network for those abused by priests. And through them, we contacted 30 or 40 of the local SNAP chapters around the country, got in touch with one in Toledo, Ohio, who told us about Tony, who had filed his case against the church, but as a John Doe, sort of, you know, not letting his name go public. But he was going to change that. He was going to go public, and he was going to meet with the local paper. So we flew out, met with him. It was a very emotional meeting. At the end of the meeting, he said he'd go ahead and do it, but he had one question. And we said, what was that? And he said, well, do you ever pay people in your documentaries? And I thought, oh, no, that's not the question I want to hear. And I said, no. And he said, well, that's good, because I don't want anybody to think that I'm doing this for money. And after that, you know, we jumped in and we made the film. We shot it for a year and a half, and he's been phenomenal.
To either of you, and perhaps both of you can speak to this, did you get the sense that the Catholic Church acknowledges finally that this is a large and widespread problem and it needs to be addressed systemically?
I think they're well at the acknowledgement phase. They're eons away from the action phase. What they have done has been window dressing. Their claims of transparency and honesty and openness are continually contradicted by no-knock search warrants having to be executed within the Toledo Diocese to look for records. All of the apologies that have come forward have been apologies that have been requested. None of it has been voluntary. None of it has been victim-specific.
Right. True contrition from moralizing sexual offenders is not something that happens.
Tony Combs, you're married. You have children. What is your relationship? What is the relationship of your children to the church?
My children, that actually was one of the bigger aspects of the movie, was deciding whether or not to allow my daughter to continue going through the process of the sacraments. And at the time, it was First Communion, which is about second grade average nationwide. That was one of the hardest things I had to do. because what I was ostensibly doing was indoctrinating her into an organization which I myself could not trust. Yet I could recall and still can recall the very magical nature of what that experience was like, even at second grade, going through First Communion, and this is Jesus on the same level of Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and everybody else. That in a child's eyes, a child's faith, I think, is the faith that we all search for, that unquestioning, knowing sense that you're being protected by something or someone higher. My wife and I have chosen to continue our children's education within the Catholic Church. They are going to public school, but they go to once-a-week classes in order to learn about Catholicism, because what I have come to realize along with my wife was that we are the Catholic Church. We don't need a priest to have a parish. The people who are sitting next to us in the pews every day, the old lady that puts the extra $10 in the basket every time the boiler breaks or the roof leaks, that doesn't have it, they're the Catholic Church. We collectively need to stand up as a group and decide to change our organization from within. And historically speaking, it's been proven. Galileo was a heretic until science outran the church's ability to outrun Galileo. It is going to take a willingness of the congregation or the body of the church to challenge the leadership of the church to make those changes occur.
And I'll tell you, it's going to be a tall order with this new pope in terms of getting things done or getting them to admit their wrongdoing on any level. And it's profound to me that you chose to stay in the church. And I assume that has something to do with the support that you got in making in revealing this stuff about yourself publicly. I imagine that the strength that you've gained from this has been incredibly profound on a family level, on a community level.
Well, the family and community support, as well as I'm a firefighter in Toledo, mm-hmm. top to bottom on the job, they have been fantastic. Mm-hmm. But the decision to stay has been more of a spiritual one.
Mm-hmm.
In that, I'm not real comfortable with people saying, Catholic religion is the only religion that's good, or
sure.
Muslims, or Jewish religion. I think we're all pointing towards the same end of the funnel. We're just throwing elbows when we get to the narrow end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the belief in a higher power is the more important part, regardless of whose flag you're flying.
I certainly admire your courage in coming out with this information, and I admire the filmmaker Kirby for making this film. And I'm assuming that one of the reasons that you did this is to make other people aware, and also if there are other victims out there, that they can to feel like there's a support system out there, and that they can find it within themselves to come forward. So maybe some of these priests will have to answer for this stuff in a real way. Is that true?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that hasn't been it's been a problem within the Catholic Church for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Forever,
really. And the way they've dealt with it is to try to sweep it under the rug for that entire length of time. And we're hopeful that these efforts finally in this new millennium that they'll be compelled to turn around, acknowledge it as a problem, and deal with it so it doesn't go on for the next several hundred or thousand years.
Ever and ever is actually 309 A.D. was the first canonical writings in regards to, hey, what's going on with the priests and the young men.
Right.
And the activities, not just young men, but activities outside of marriage. The church has, through different writings, which then address the previous writing, in canonical law, have addressed these things year after year after year, century after century, since Catholicism really began.
They almost went bankrupt in Boston because of this, and they still haven't, actually put a formal announcement of apology or admission. And it's, you would think that this particular church, Catholic Church, as wealthy as it is, taking a hit economically, would at least, motivate them to change things around.
And to a person, economically speaking, this has never, ever been about money. It has been about acknowledgement and restitution, both from an emotional sense and, unfortunately, due to civil and criminal laws, the way they're set up state by state, that what the victims wanted most was closure. But
right. We
cannot sue you for your front door.
That's right.
And when we are left in the arena of civil court, which is the arena of the church's choosing due to their actions, had they been straightforward all along, when we're left in the arena of civil court, money does become the common denominator.
Well, that's how you can hurt them. It's understandable. It's not just about profiteering. It's about taking a punch where it hurts.
They claim that we're going to bankrupt them or that we're all out for money, but they're the only ones talking about money this whole time. They're the ones who bring it up constantly.
Right. Well, you know, I really appreciate you being here, Tony Combs, and also the director of the film, Kirby Dick. I hope it has a tremendous impact and makes people aware of the reality of this horrendous thing on behalf of the Catholic Church.
I'm honored to be here and honored to be associated with these guys. I couldn't thank them enough for doing this with such dignity.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, the film is called Twist of Faith. It premieres tomorrow night on HBO. Up next, we got the Monday job listing. Beefgate, Matt Cow is here.
Yeah.
Morning Remembrance is coming up. It's 46 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio. Stay with us.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
One past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. Look, folks, I wish Johnny Casey were here to take some bets on whether or not Rehnquist, Judge Rehnquist, is going to resign today, which is a speculation with so much on the menu. We're going to get into that in a second. We're going to get into Beefgate in a second. Mad Cow is here. You know, maybe you should have stopped eating that meat 5 years ago, because I didn't, and I'm scared, and I don't mean to scare people, but man, the way the USDA and the FDA, you know, are in cahoots to keep the truth from us in the name of big business, as usual, this administration and this government operates in the name of big business, not in the name of the safety, health, or concern for the people of this country. We're going to get into that. We got Ted Leo coming up in the next hour for you Ted Leo fans, so
yeah,
stay around for that. We got Morning Remembrance coming up, but right now we talked about, at least on the network, there was some talk about the military psychiatrists and psychologists who advised interrogators at Guantanamo on effective torture techniques. Well, it looks like they need some more help, because we found this in the classifieds, and it's our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Mental health professionals needed. The U.S. military is seeking qualified psychoanalysts with the emphasis on the psycho part. Can you provide people with nurturing, support, and healing? And can you turn that on its head? We need mental health professionals who can help people get in touch with their feelings, as long as those feelings are fear and traumatic stress. You will be helping people to live with their fears. In fact, if you're doing your job right, they'll be living with their fears all the time. In short, you must know how to treat mental illness as an opportunity. Applicant must be familiar with the theories of Freud, Jung, and Mengele. Ideally, you will be also be familiar with electroshock therapy as applied to testicles. If you consider One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to be a training film, contact us immediately. Dig that. So I guess that's, yeah, you know what that is. So Rehnquist is, the Chief Justice is expected to retire at any second, apparently. Many people think it could be today. There's some speculation that he might wait until the fall or try to serve another term, but there's a lot of cases on the menu, and you know, right now, Riley, some of these are going to be decided today.
Yeah, some people may remember the name Valerie Plame. That's the wife of one of our frequent guests,
yeah,
Ambassador Joe Wilson.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Plame case may be decided today. That's going to decide, the court may decide whether or not to take up the appeals of Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper and New York Times reporter Judith Miller, neither of whom wrote or outed Valerie Plame, but they actually were facing some jail time. There's also the Ten Commandments case.
Ah, whether or not it can be displayed in public on government property.
Yeah, and there's also the question of file sharing, whether or not there is some liability of Internet file sharing services for their clients' illegal swapping of songs and movies. A lot of people in the entertainment biz, Mara, will be looking very closely at that.
Yep.
But, of course, everyone is looking most closely at Rehnquist. They're all looking. He's 80 years old. He's got cancer. He has not said whether he's got the most serious type of thyroid cancer, but he has said that he has thyroid cancer. And remember, too, that Justice John Paul Stevens, is 85 years old. He's 5 years older than Rehnquist.
Oh.
There's a possibility that One person may retire, both may retire, or none may retire alternate.
So if Rehnquist retires, how do we start the process then? You know, what happens now? Is it going to reopen the entire religious battle over appointments? I mean, what happens then, Riley?
Well, what happens then is George W. Bush comes up with a nominee. And, of course, just like with Iraq, that's hard work for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to find somebody. My guess is he will find someone that will be somewhat satisfactory to the religious right. But, of course, the key question is going to be the abortion issue. And you know how they're going to play it, Maron. Whoever Bush nominates will not, when he goes before the, he or she goes before the Senate, they will not take a hard and fast position on abortion. Hopefully, for the conservatives, they will not have a paper trail of rulings on abortion to key in, for Democrats to key in on how they may vote. Bush is going to try and play this as close to the vest as possible, and then once the person is confirmed, then they'll make their position on abortion clear, and my guess is they will be looking to strike down Roe v. Wade.
Oh, man, so it's going to get heavy, dude.
It's going to get heavy.
It's already heavy.
And it will be heavier if Stevens retires, because Stevens is, quote, one of the liberal wing of the party. And see, the religious right is scared to death that they may end up, Bush may end up nominating somebody like Anthony Kennedy, who has turned out to be a liberal in conservative clothing as far as they're concerned.
Right.
Anthony Kennedy has sided against them on some very key issues. They want someone they can rely on. When I say they, I'm talking about the religious right here. They want someone who is reliable, someone who they believe shares their view of the world, which scares the crap out of me.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we're going to have our jobs cut out for us, around this stuff in the next few weeks. Also, folks, how do they mix up the remains of the mad cow and three other ones,
God,
right? How do the tissue samples get screwed up? Okay, you ask, how is it that they've known about this case of mad cow that was revealed on Friday since November and not told us? You ask, how are they still feeding the remains of cows and other animal remnants of cows to cows and getting away with it when there are laws against that? You ask all these questions. Well, I say it's a cover-up. I'm going to call it Beefgate, and I want to tell you that, this thing scares me more than most things because of this administration's disregard for public health and their complete regard and bending over for corporate interests in America. We're going to be talking about that coming up next. We've got Ted Leo coming up. We've got Morning Remembrance coming up, so stay with us.
We ain't don't go anywhere. We're not. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, the Marks on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses.
Good morning.
Philosopher, kings, and queens, working class heroes. Speaking of working class heroes, I was watching cable. That's always great about cable is you never know what you're going to be surprised with. You're so rarely surprised. There's so rarely something on. I tuned into Imagine John Lennon, which came out in 88, that documentary assembled of Lennon clips and just interviews with him. And I was crying. I was crying because I don't know whether it was because of how much we all were familiarized with the Beatles, but this guy was a very genuine, beautiful guy who spoke his mind, not only in his songs, but later in his life. The whole idea of protest in terms of, he was very sort of it doesn't matter what the intellectuals were saying or anything else. Peace is something we should really aspire to. And the only thing that I really know in my life is that I wish peace for everybody, and my reality is limited to the love that I feel in my life in its immediate circle. But I will, because of my public presence, grow in front of you and speak my mind in front of you because I have no choice. But he was not a guy caught up with intellectual framings or even politics per se.
No, he wasn't. And see, I always thought that the Beatles represented something important in that they were all working class kids. And remember that in Britain, you know, the class system is a lot more rigid than it is here in the States. But here were guys who actually transcended Britain's class system in many instances to make a difference in the world. It's interesting you mentioned that whole peace thing, because this morning I woke up, and for some reason, the proposal that Dennis Kucinich made, the congressman from Ohio, to actually, if he was president, construct a Department of Peace, for some reason that stuck in my head all morning.
Really? That's weird that I bring that then, because I really thought that the idea of aspiring to it, of realizing that it's a possibility, and what an amazing world would be to have that part of your head that realizes that, like, even when I was stuck in traffic on the highway because of Billy Graham's speech, you know, and I'm looking at other people in their cars, and I'm seeing the amount of traffic and the amount of smog and the amount of people that are so selfish. Some days when you sit in traffic, you can really just look around and say, we're doomed because people's priorities aren't right. They're just not right. Everyone's got their own personal agenda, their own entitlements, their own desire to get to where they want to go when they want to get there, with no regard for other people or the planet at large. And it was just beautiful to see this John Lennon thing and be moved to tears just by the very nature that, you know, because he had a public outlet, that all he was saying is that we could be so great.
Yeah,
you know,
if we were smarter.
Yeah. In an attempt to counter the latest poll, some saying that 49% of the people believe that he started the war and not Saddam Hussein. George W. Bush is designing.
What? That poll was hilarious.
I know. Unbelievable.
I love that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a complete change of public tone. And now he's got to really put together his sort of like, well, say, hard work.
Hard work.
Yeah. This is his whole pitch for tomorrow night at Fort Bragg. He's going to stand before the military, before the country, and feed us a line of hokum that's going to be unsurpassed.
Why don't you just go ahead and say it?
What?
He's going to pimp the soldiers.
Oh, that's for sure.
That's what he's doing.
It's just from all indications, not only is it a quagmire on the ground there, but the information coming out of the administration, out of the military, out of analysts, that there's a propaganda, one of the great propaganda techniques of the neocon death cult is creating an informational quagmire, so it becomes very difficult to see what the truth is. But the truth is that people on the ground, some of the military saying, look, this is unwinnable on a military level. Donald Rumsfeld has admitted that they've reached out and they're having talks with parts of the insurgency that are Sunnis and trying to integrate them into the political process. They are all unwilling to admit that they have to get out of there, that they don't have enough troops there to begin with, that people aren't signing up for the military like they used to, that you have troops that are overextended along the Syrian border, that it's a disaster.
Well, yeah, and when you have to threaten schools with, a withdrawal of federal funding just to get them to allow military people in the campus, you understand what George Bush has done, which is really to give the insurgents the gift of a lack of a plan.
Yep, and it's unbelievable that he had the condescension and the cojones to make a joke about it. Judy Keene of USA Today asked him a question about his second-term slump. And asking him if he's in one, and Bush responds, quote, a quagmire, perhaps, end quote, to make light of it like that. And then an Iraqi reporter asked him, quote, when will you begin the reconstruction in Iraq?
As soon as we find the $8.8 billion that was supposed to fund it. That's when.
$8.8 is like, that's just the part that's missing.
I know.
The other stuff, at least they know where the duffel bags full of cash went, to that guy with the khaki hat on, to that guy with the Halliburton suit on. You know, quote, and this is what he says. He says, Bush says, quote, we are spending reconstruction money, end quote. Then he goes, quote, but, you know, you need to ask that to the government. They're in charge. It's your government, not ours, end quote. We sent the duffel bags over there. How'd they get into the wrong hands?
Yeah, ask the Middle Eastern guy to my left over here. I mean, do you know how condescending it must be to have the head of the Iraqi government standing there and to have Bush tell a reporter, no, ask him.
Unbelievable. And on top of that, I am freaking out about Mad Cow.
You know,
we all know the neocon death cult is bad. We all know that they're liars. We all know that there's even more evidence out of England that it wasn't just a Downing Street memo, but there are other memos now that say that, you know, they were bombing Iraq in 2002. But what we don't know is that Mad Cow has probably been in this country for at least 10 years. The Agriculture Department confirmed that a cow that died last year was infected with Mad Cow. It died last year, people. Last year, all right? A test was conducted 7 months ago indicating that the animal had the disease, but the result was never publicly disclosed. This is a second case of mad cow disease in the United States. The first was in December 2003 from a cow in Washington State that was imported from Canada. Thank God at that time they could blame Canada. Who do they blame now? I'm telling you, man, this is scary stuff. And they had this cow was tested twice, all right? An experimental test was performed last November on the brain of the cow suspected of having the mad cow. Experimental, they said. Read, if it had come out negative, it would have been a definitive test, all right? But this experimental test came out positive, all right? And because it became out positive, it did not give the results that the USDA wanted, so they called it experimental. And then they did another test shortly before the experimental test, referred to the USDA as their gold standard. What the hell does that even mean? You know what it means? It came out negative. So they went with that one. They said the first one was experimental, yet they didn't do the,
Western blot.
The Western blot test in England from a country where they've actually had mad cow cases. So they finally sent it into England at behest of what's that woman's name?
Phyllis Fong, Inspector General of the Agriculture Department.
There was enough fear that they had to do that, and it comes out positive. All right? It's just, it's mind blowing to me that the USDA is now, they're trying to blame the scientists on some level because Ed Lloyd, a USDA spokesman, quote, said, the laboratory folks just never mentioned it to anyone higher up. They didn't know whether it was valid or not, so they didn't report it. This is in light of the experimental test. Like, scientists would do that. The nation's health
is at risk, but I'm going to tell you something, Maren.
What?
When you go home today, double lock your door, all right? I don't want anybody to go...
Yeah.
Maren?
The guy from the beach.
Maren, you're messing with our product, Maren.
Well, that's the whole thing. The reason that they don't have efficient testing here is it would slow down production. And yep. The weird thing about this, Hal, this is the other thing that makes me the suspect, is like apparently, according to John Gifford, the USDA chief veterinarian, when the remains, the cow, the tissue samples were mislabeled. Because of a couple reasons. It could have been soiled with so much manure that it was hard to tell what breed it was. Or the brain tissues were mixed up with other tissue samples from other cows. Apparently parts from the diseased animal were supposed to be kept separate, but they somehow got mixed up with remains of four other cows. Could it be sabotage? I don't know. All I know is that all of this is going on. It's another, the same type of propaganda the neocon death uses around Iraq. It's a propaganda of informational quagmire where there's so much conflicting information coming out. And after all is said and done, we do have a case of mad cow in the country, and this country still feeds, animal remains to cows, cow remains to cows through a bunch of different avenues.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can you tell me exactly what dried restaurant plate waste is?
Yeah, it's like dried gross garbage, like, a piece of meat that was all dried up and gross and rancid.
They just crush it up because they feed cows that, and they do it legally.
Well, let's just listen to this sound real quick of a guest we had on our show, John Stauber. He is the co-author of Mad Cow USA. Explained that although the Bush administration says that cows and livestock are not being fed back to other cattle, that is a lie. And this is actually the only way that this disease gets transmitted among livestock. So let's hear what John Stauber had to say.
We know now that mad cow disease is here in North America. It's been here for a decade. And despite that, the United States government is simply lying to the public about the safeguards we've taken. Mad cow disease is spread through feeding cows, slaughterhouse waste from cows and other livestock. We hear that we have a firewall feed ban in the United States that has prevented this since 1997. The reality is, no, that's not the truth. It's just a labeling restriction, and legally, hundreds of millions of pounds of slaughterhouse waste are fed back to cattle every year. The cattle industry simply won't give it up because they make so much money by turning slaughterhouse waste into animal feed, but other countries have banned it and are stopping the spread of the disease that way.
That was John Stauber from our show from last week. He was the co-author, is the co-author of Mad Cow USA. And just in closing here, in terms of this issue, I want to tell you what Agriculture Secretary Mike Johans said on Saturday. Quote, let's just reassure people there's nothing to worry about relative to BSE, which is a mad cow in beef. Our safeguards work to keep the animal away from our food supply. The fact that this animal is blocked from entering the food supply tells us that our safeguards are working exactly as they should. So there you go. Rest assured, people. Sleep.
Yeah.
We got Ted Leo coming up. We got Morning Remembrance coming up. And we got, man, it's going to be a great power punch to the end of this show. I'll tell you that. So that's all next at 17 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Good morning. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, and look who I see in the other studio. It's Ted Leo warming
all
up.
Right.
He's going to tune up his guitar. He's going to have some coffee. He's going to get all jacked up and jam in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Right. How's that for pressure? Right now, thanks to everyone who, again, came down to Tea Lounge on Friday. If you missed it, we had a great time. If you want to see us again, we'll be at Vox Pop in Flatbush, Brooklyn next Friday, July 8th. We will?
Yeah?
That's not this Friday. It's a Friday from
a week from Friday.
Oh, okay. I'm glad to know we're going to go there.
It's Flatbush now, huh?
Yeah, Flatbush.
What's next, man? Hey, Coney Island, Canarsie?
Well, who knows? And I think we're trying to plan an outing up to Harlem.
Yeah, hopefully
we'll get that. Maybe we'll
in the heart of the community.
We'll try and cajole Bill Clinton to come down from his office. But right now, unfortunately, it's that time of week. Well, maybe I should change my tone of voice then.
Really.
When we hear it, Morning Sedition. Take a moment to reflect at this time of sorrow, to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of the grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh.
You all right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Bernd Meisner, giant in the world of polka. Everybody loves a funeral. Bernd Meisner, who once achieved an international following for his accordion-propelled polka tunes, died last week after an incensed obese woman crushed him against a beer barrel during the second verse of Oh No, She's Too Fat for Me. She's Too Fat for Me. She's Too Fat for Me.
Take it easy, man.
All right.
You want a Kleenex?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, man. I like it. Oh, allergies.
Yeah, I
got
know, man.
Ficus in here.
Yeah, got one in my pocket.
Born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Meisner picked up his first accordion at age 8. And by 11, was playing in local bars while depressed, out-of-work factory workers suggestively rubbed their kielbasas on his keyboard.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's rough, man.
It's rough.
Yeah.
Fans say Meisner sang and played polkas like no other. Which isn't much of a surprise because no other would have wanted to. In his heyday, Meisner was heavily influenced by the popular songs and dance music of the 1960s, best illustrated by his breakthrough 1968 hit, Acid Barrel Polka.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, it's really trippy.
You all right, man?
Nice. You've been eating the slaughterhouse waste?
No, none of that.
Yeah,
I was a couple months ago, but...
No more. I'm allergic to that. It's making my eyes tear up, I guess. Anyway, before he died, Meisner said he wanted to be remembered as the accordion player most responsible for influencing three generations of musicians to take up the guitar.
Yeah.
Jack S. Kilby, inventor of the microchip.
Jack Kilby, the modest and mild-mannered inventor of the microchip who revolutionized the world of electronics, died last week after finally realizing how many trillions of dollars he could have made had he not been so modest and mild-mannered. Kilby began his engineering career at Texas Instruments.
Okay, buddy.
Texas Instruments with a passionate desire to make things small. Little did he know he'd achieve his greatest success with his salary. Are you giving me the 1 minute mark?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. This is Jack Kilby and microchip. Okay, look, I'll skip down to the bottom.
You can
all right.
Go ahead.
His death was announced by Texas Instruments, who at long last acknowledged his huge debt they owed him by giving his family a brand new plastic corpse protector.
Oh, no.
Kilby requested his body be combined with 100 million other dead electrical engineers, shrunk down to the size of a paperclip, and used to help more teenagers take naked photos of each other with their cell phones.
Wow. That's something.
Yeah. He buried like a microchip.
I get it. Yeah, it's good stuff.
I'm not making this up. What do you mean this is good stuff?
I'm sorry, buddy. Now you got Riley blowing his nose. It's a party in here. You like Ted Leo, Mort?
Oh, I love Ted Leo.
So he's going to be here in a few minutes. He's going to come in here and jam, and he does jam.
Yeah.
And he's a very smart guy, and he's a politically active guy. We'll talk to him. We'll hear him play some music.
Sure.
Thank you, Mort, Jim, for being here.
Thanks.
It's always great to see you.
Bye, Mark.
Hang out. Coming up next, Ted Leo's coming. Just hang out.
Boarding Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
When we last left Mark and Grace, they were tied together in an empty abortion clinic as a bomb planted by Randall Terry ticked away.
This is the longest time bomb I've ever seen in my life. We've been tied up for 6 hours. Where's News Daddy?
Where's News Daddy, you ask? As a matter of fact, he's 20,000 light years from Earth, fighting an intergalactic battle against crime.
I'm looking for alien kingpin, Whack Whack Weevil.
He's not here. But you can talk to Bizarre Underworld, Sugar Snacks.
What up, Funky Spaceman?
I hear you and your oozing green homeboys are pushing kilos of high-grade squeak. Alpha Centauri is squeaked out, and I'm ending it right now.
You're pretty far out of your hood, News Daddy. Look around. Me and my boys are about to pump you full of protoplasm.
Your dope dealing days are over, you little green squeak freak.
I regard that as racist. Fire! You defeated us. We have never fought the likes of you before. What kind of creature cannot be hurt, cannot be shot, cannot be vanquished?
And look so funky fresh.
News Daddy, get on board! The planet is about to blow!
Wayne Gilman.
Meanwhile, back where Mark and Grace are tied up at the abortion clinic.
Hello? We're still here. Grace, do you have any ideas? Grace, wake up! Grace!
Will Grace wake up in time to avoid being blown to pieces? Will we ever see News Daddy again? Or will he time travel back to the only age that matters? The age of disco. Do you remember this one? That's next week on Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
Success the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Thank you for being here. Our guest, who's been our guest many times, who's been on the same tour since the last time we talked to him, which was months ago. He's currently on tour with The Pharmacist. Their latest CD, Shake the Streets, was released last year. They just... Sheets.
Yeah.
Shake the sheets.
I was going to let that one slide, but you know, it's early. You
shake
know.
The sheets. Wow. Somebody has to be spoken to. Wow. I, you know what's weird is I have the album, yet I still said shake the streets because it's sitting here in front of me on the paper, Ted. I'm going to shoot myself.
I've seen posters at clubs that have the record cover, which clearly says sheets on it, and then below it, the new album, Shake the Streets. Don't worry about it.
So you guys, this is Ted Leo, folks.
Yeah.
You guys just played last night at Irving Plaza, sold out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How was it, man? Great?
It was great. It really was, yeah. I mean, from my perspective, anyway.
Are you able to take adulation? You know what I mean?
Yeah, not very far, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't take it, yeah.
I mean, I performed in New Jersey at a Holiday Inn on Route 17 the other night in Bananas Comedy Club, and people were, like, really excited. I had some real fans there, and I was sort of like, are you sure? You sure you like me?
Yeah, you know, it's like playing a sold out Irving Plaza is something that has come late enough in life to me that you kind of it's all
you're ready. You deserve it, right?
Or you're not even so much you deserve, but you just have a healthy distance from that kind of aspect of it. So.
And you've got great fans. I mean, you've got some real dedicated fans. You got
truly, yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you, when you played, when we were in Boston, I think you played Spirit of Radio, and I swear to God, some guy's head almost exploded. Like, he just couldn't even believe, like, oh my God, Rush and Ted Leo. You remember that?
I do remember that.
He was going crazy, that guy. And so, where are you going to be? You're going to be at Maxwell's tonight.
Yes.
And you are, you know, you're also, like, I remember talking about this before, you're vegan. So you heard about the mad cow thing. Were you sort of like, knew it?
I heard you talking about it earlier, actually. Yeah. And I think I remember, did we have some, like, snarky interchange about that back in Boston?
I don't think I'd stopped eating meat.
You had.
It was snarky.
Yeah.
Well, guess what?
That was pretty snarky.
Oh! Well, I'm born again meatless, man.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been, like 4 months.
Uh-huh.
I'm still eating fish, despite being told by a woman in Brooklyn that I should really look at fish because they're beautiful.
It's true.
You feel the same way?
I do.
So what do you like? Let's say Ted Leo is like, I'm starving.
Yeah.
I want a big meal. Yeah. What does that look like?
A big meal with no meat or fish, man. There's a world of, you know, I mean.
So we're talking rice grains.
Sometimes.
Maybe a piece of cheese.
No dairy. You know, no dairy.
Strict
either, vegan. He's
like my younger brother. He's strict like that. Yeah.
Wow. So, okay. So we've got rice grains, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, also, like, I like the fake cold cuts for those sandwiches every now and then.
You like the fake meat cuts?
I get into this argument with people sometimes because they're like, well, this is what it says, blah, blah, blah. You know, but the thing is, like.
Which one is that?
You know that argument. You know?
Sure, I have it all the time.
Blah, blah, blah,
well, argument. Yeah, we do hear a lot.
Yeah. But, like, you know, I mean, with the not to get, you know, too deep into this whole thing, but, I mean, the processed, like, cutlets that come onto your normal sandwich are so far removed from the source anyway at that point.
It's from the animal, yeah.
Yeah, you're used to a taste and a texture, and, you know, and that's what it is.
Okay, so you're just saying sort of like, well, it looks like cold cut.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah,
no, I have that. I recently bought some Boca burgers, which I've had before. Very, very good.
A piece of
spelt bread with some soy sweet cheese.
You went all the way to spelt bread.
Yeah.
You went from eating meat to spelt bread in 8 months.
My wife has a weed allergy, so she can only eat spelt bread.
Right.
But I toasted and I got the Boca burgers with the soy Swiss cheese sprouts, some pickles and mustard, and that's like a Ted Leo sandwich.
Sounds good, man.
Can I call it the Ted Leo?
Yeah, you can call it the Ted Leo.
You want to play a song, man? Did you come here to play some songs?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so Ted Leo will be at Maxwell's tonight. The new album is Shake the Sheets,
we're gonna
have Ted play a song here. Let's do it up. What are we going
to
hear?
I'm going to attempt to do one from the record called Counting Down the Hours.
Okay, cool.
In a sense, it never will. Accidents mean no one's guilty. Ignorance means someone's killed. So I asked him, Mr. Miller, how to get to where one's gone. And he points to his survival. And he points me down the road. And I go, all alone, leaving out alone. Wondering if I got a soul. Counting down the hours till it goes. dark wet night in April on a street in Jersey where I went looking for some writing that I knew would not be there. And I punched out from the tellers and the police in the rain. We're concerned more with the car than with the fact the light had changed. But after listening all morning as I drove down 95 to a story of detainees who were barely kept alive, I could deal with trying to process pigeons acting like they're thugs, but not with interference from the power line above. As I go all alone, the little I know, wondering if I got a stone, counting down the hours till it goes wrong. Precautions, yes, precautions. But if you're playing with a gun, you could kill someone. And in the dark, it's hard to know a friend. But I'm not hungry. I won't be forever angry. Cause I'm walking toward tomorrow with a rifle in my hand. And I'm thinking about New England, and I'm missing old Japan. And I'm not near California where it's spring runs hot and cold. And if I told you I felt ageless, would you tell me I'm not old? As I got all alone, the little I know, wondering if I got a soul, counting down the hours till it goes. All alone, a little out of low, wondering if I got a soul, counting down the hours till it goes.
Ted Leo, yeah. Amazing.
You say too much.
Shake the Sheets is the new CD. They're going to be at Maxwell's tonight. I'm assuming that's sold out in Hoboken.
In Hoboken, New Jersey.
You know, we're going to regroup here, and then you can decide whether you want to do another song.
Okay.
But either way, he will be here when we return with Ted Leo, and we're going to have the Cliff Notes and more of me and Mark. So stay with us. It's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio, 44 past the hour.
Morning's Edition on the air. MorningsEdition.com, Air America Radio.
The hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Good morning.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. We're going to land this thing with Ted Leo, who you're listening to now, and you just listened to here and live in the studio the last, before the break there. He's still here. Ted Leo is on. Tonight is the last night of a tour that's gone on for how long, Ted?
Well, it's kind of essentially been like about 8 months or so.
Wow.
We've had a couple of weeks off here and there.
You know? So how does it, does the tour, do you get people that follow you? I mean, in terms of
style.
Are you the pop fish?
No, God, no. I sincerely hope not. You know,
I imagine that some of the people that were at Irving Plaza will probably be at Maxwell's. They probably are coming.
That could be, yeah. It's local. I mean, every time, sometimes when we play somewhere, we haven't played other sort of regional, like, you know, you play Cleveland and not Detroit, and some people will come from Detroit.
Sure,
you know.
Yeah, I get it.
Now, Ted, I don't want to date myself here and sound like I'm too old school, but do you ever do gigs and then somebody from a record company, from one of the majors, comes up and says, listen, man, you know, we can really do something with you?
Very rarely.
But it has happened.
Yeah, it's happened, yeah.
And how do you react? Because you're still an independent reporter.
Yeah, I usually say thanks, you know, maybe even meet with them to see what they have to say, and you know, but usually kind of wind up walking away.
Right, you say thanks, and then thanks for lunch.
Yeah. I didn't say that, by the way. That was not me. I could get probably a couple more free lunches out of it.
So are you working on a new record?
We'll be starting on Wednesday of this week, actually.
Oh, there you go.
You're going into the studio on Wednesday?
No, I'm going into my bedroom and write some new songs on Wednesday.
Is that the process? You just sort of isolate and do it?
Yeah, kind
of. You got any big plans for the vacation outside of writing songs? You and your wife going anywhere?
Totally staying at home.
Hey,
good. And where is home?
I actually just moved up to Rhode Island a little while ago. So.
Rhode Island, that's not some place you hear people going to too often. Yay, I'm going to Rhode Island.
Yeah, well, let's keep that
quiet. Let's keep it quiet. I won't tell anybody. All right, so you want to? How's your voice feeling? You feel like playing another song?
I figure, yeah.
Okay,
there you go.
Go for broke.
All right.
Do a Curtis Mayfield song and go down in flames, or you know, or move on.
I like the risk. We're living on the edge here with Ted Leo.
All right.
I got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way, somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Now look a look, look a look, look a yonder. Now what's that I see? A great big stone. Oh, they're ahead of me. But I've got my pride and I move them all aside and just keep on pushing. Ha, ha, hallelujah. Ha, hallelujah. Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. Now maybe someday, reach that higher goal. I know I can make it with just a little bit of soul. I've got my strength and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Ha, ha, hallelujah. Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. Amen. 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 Amen.
Wow, that was...
He did it justice. Now, you know, that song was one of those gospel pieces that not everyone took as a protest song right away.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is Curtis Mayfield really made his bones doing protest music.
Oh, yeah.
And Keep On Pushing was part of that whole gospel double meaning kind
of thing. Right. That sounded great, man.
Yeah.
Your voice is right on the edge. We're talking to Ted Leo. We're listening to Ted Leo. Now, do you... Like, I've heard people refer to you as sort of a politically active, a sort of a pop statesman of the left. How do you feel about that?
Pop statesman of the left? Well, you've got something to live up to now.
You can use that. What are some of the things that you've been pretty passionate about and involved with lately in terms of political activism?
Well, first of all, being on tour every night is you know, an amazing opportunity to actually discuss things. And, you know, most of my songs have political content, so there's that kind of conversation that goes on with the audience every night.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I actually have been trying to do as many kind of interviews with political organizations, Center for American Progress, you know, things like that, just to get, like, you know, get kind of youth involved in things that more than anything just keep them informed, because that's one of the biggest problems, I think. Like, I mean, just take the Downing Street memo, you know.
Sure.
It's been out there, you know.
Sure.
You know, it's like you have to, like, you really have to go the extra mile with the media these days and keep yourself informed.
And you're helping get young people, you know, into that process of,
yeah,
of trying, realizing that. Yeah, that's great, man. Ted Leo, thanks for being with us. The latest CD is called Shake the Sheets. He'll be at Maxwell's tonight, and he's going to go home to where he lives in an undisclosed location and sit in his bedroom and write his next CD this week. It was great seeing you.
Thanks,
again.
You guys. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Ted.
Sure. Thanks for coming. There's the sound of the fax machine with the liberal agenda. It's our weekly liberal agenda from the Streisand compounds. So here are your marching orders for this week. Liberals, write these down. One, protest the use of the term mad cow disease as disrespectful to the morbidly obese mentally ill. Two, for the fourth year in a row, offer therapy and understanding for our attackers.
Wow.
Three, call Bush's bluff and take a tour of Guantanamo. Note, make sure to dress like indigenous Cubans so as not to spread ugly American image. Four, for the 4th of July, develop a firework rocket that shoots up in the air, explodes, and spells out the Downing Street memo in red, white, and blue lights. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Hey, isn't Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari just Hamid Karzai without the stupid hat? Wake up, sheeple. Bush has more puppets than Jim Henson.
Lord.
How do you like that? Tomorrow, we're going to get into Iraq on the day of the eve of Bush's address to Fort Bragg on the year anniversary of the turnover. Iraq, he's going to try and sell his BS bill of goods to the public and to the military, and we're going to have Noah Feldman, who helped draft the original Iraqi constitution for the interim government, discuss what he sees in the future of Iraq.
Not only that, well, you know, they elected a hard-line president of Iran, right next door to Iraq, and Borzu Dereghahi, Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist and one of the regulars on our show, friend of the room. Mm-hmm. He'll be here. He'll discuss Iran and Iraq. And we're going to have someone named Peter Kaminsky talk to us about something neither of you guys mess with anymore. Ham!
The perfect search for ham. The Noah Feldman also on the state of Iraq's political process. I already said that, didn't I?
Don't worry about it.
Now I said it twice. Noah Feldman. Now I said it three times. Noah Feldman.
Can I say it once?
Four. Yeah.
Noah Feldman.
All right. It's been great seeing you, Riley.
Great seeing you. Thanks, Ted.
Thank
we'll
you.
Do it all again tomorrow on Air America Radio.